It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
We're getting close to the end of season 13, a great season full of great conversations about films nominated in various awards categories from each decade.
We're currently working through the films nominated for the 2002 Film Independent Spirit Awards for Best Cinematography. Those are
The American Astronaut,
The Deep End,
Hedwig and the Angry Inch,
and Mulholland Drive.
There's also Memento, but we talked about that in a previous season.
It was Pete's pick from our spoiled Rotten Twist Endings series back in season 10, to be precise.
Like we did earlier this season when we rebroadcast previous conversations that were a part of our 1940 Academy Award Best Picture series.
And like we did with Dr. Strangelove for our 1965 BAFTA's Best Film from Any Source series, we wanted to bring this one back as well.
So enjoy this blast from the past, streamlined to focus just on the film itself.
Thank you, everybody, for downloading and listening to The Next Reel. We appreciate your time and attention, and we hope you enjoy the show.
I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
And we are two passionate movie lovers who love talking about movies passionately.
Uh-huh. Welcome to The Next Reel.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Memento is over. We all lie to ourselves to be happy.
Where am I? Some anonymous motel room.
I guess I've already told you about my condition.
Oh, well, only every time I see you.
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No. It's different from that. I have no short-term memory. I know who I am. I know all about myself. Since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades. I've told you this before, haven't I?
What's the last thing that you do remember?
My wife. Dying. My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless.
Hi, Andy.
Yo.
How do you feel about Memento? It's kicking off a new series, a very brief series, a duo.
It is a pair of films in our kind of a twist ending series. This was, I think, listener Ben Lott's idea, who had an idea for a series called Spoiled. Rotten? All about twist endings. If you know it, and the ending has been spoiled for you, does the film just not stand up on its own? Is the twist the thing, or does it actually still contain a good movie there? So that's what we're here to talk about. We each picked one. You picked Memento. Next week, we'll be talking about my choice, Identity. But I think Christopher Nolan's Memento is a great way to kick this very brief series that's ending our season off.
Yeah, I think so too. I really do. And I feel like this is a great way to start. I may have cheated because I think on reviewing Memento, really, we don't spoil the ending with Memento. You spoil the middle. Anyway, it's all about the mechanic. I do think it begs the question, Andy, how do you feel about endings that are twisty endings?
Twisty. I like twist endings. I think that they make for great films often. And, I like when a story throws in a surprise like that. And I feel like there are times they work better than others. And in general, it's just because largely the film is better, than some other films where they throw a twist in there and it just feels like, well, I feel like they were just trying to come up with something to shake things up a little bit, and it didn't necessarily need to go there. In this particular case, I think that this one definitely holds up, but I enjoy twist endings as long as the film isn't just built for a twist.
Well, I think that's true. And I think that is, thinking about twist endings that are particularly effective, but don't merit many rewatches. For me, I think that the one at the very top of the list is The Sixth Sense. Like, I haven't gone back and watched it. I've seen it twice, and that, it turns out, was enough. Is that
really?
Is that funny? Yeah.
Like, that's, I get, funny. It. That's depressing, because that movie is so good.
Yeah, it's good. But like, once I've gotten the payoff, that's one that I feel like I was done. I was finished.
Huh. Interesting.
Not that the movie was bad, but that the movie was in fact spoiled. And I think, to your term, in my head, that movie exists for the ending. And once you kind of unlock that level, it doesn't have a lot left to offer.
And see, I think that that's a case in point for a perfect example of one where everything is working brilliantly. And I think it holds up on multiple rewatches, even when you know everything that's happening. And so that's one where I really am happy with how that one unfolds. So,
well, maybe it's because you actually do see dead people, and so it's more of a documentary.
Very true.
It hasn't touched it. So give me an example of one that you feel like does not work.
I guess no matter what, we're kind of spoiling things for other people at this particular point, not just these ones we're talking about. But I'd say, okay, if you're looking at a movie that feels like the twist ending was designed, you know, everything kind of is forced into this twist ending, there are a few that come to mind. One, we've talked about the Planet of the Apes movies, and I have to say the twist ending that the Tim Burton's version decided to throw in there just really made no sense. That one felt to me like the ultimate twist ending. We're like, we got to do a twist, but it's got to be different than the original twist. Really irritated me.
Yeah.
Did not like that one at all. Also, there's a horror film that I actually thought was really good, and then the twist ending happens, and all of a sudden I'm like, well, wait a minute. So much of the movie doesn't make sense now. And it's a French horror film called High Tension. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it, but it just doesn't make sense once you know what the twist is. And it was very frustrating for me when that one happened. Last but not least, I would say, The Life of David Gale, which isn't a horrible movie. It's actually kind of interesting, just story about the death penalty and everything. But when you realize like what's going on at the end, I'm like, they did this big twist in that one. I'm like, well, I don't know how much that one ends up, making me like that movie at all.
One of the ones that came up because it was one that Christopher Nolan had suggested, and in his words, and I like the way he puts this, it's one that treats you well, right? It's not a snap ending that doesn't reward you for going back and watching it again. And I had totally forgotten that this movie even existed. And in fact, if you had asked me to give you a movie in which Lisa Bonet, Mickey Rourke, and Robert De Niro were in together, I would not have been able to tell you this movie. It completely vanished from memory. It's Angel Heart from 1987. And so I went back and kind of refreshed myself with some clips, and I realized that really does. That is a movie that gives you an example of something spooky, neo-noir, lots of craziness in it. And yet at the end, once you know what's going on, you go back and can watch the movie, and it has changed the way you see the film. And I think that's the reward of these movies. When they're spoiled and not rotten, the reward is it kind of feels like a new movie when you watch it again, but it's equally entertaining as the first time you watch it. And maybe that there's a secondary joy in introducing it to other people.
Sure. Yeah, I recently rewatched Angel Heart, and I found that it definitely holds up. That's a fun, creepy one.
Yeah, it makes me want to watch the whole thing again. I've watched now, 5-minute segments from throughout the movie. And yeah, fantastic. So that's why I ended up picking Memento, because not so much that there is a snap ending to the movie, that once you see this one snap ending, it changes the way you see the movie, but the whole thing, the entire mechanic, is the Christopher Nolan mechanic, the Christopher and Jonathan Nolan mechanic, where say what you will about the ending, it's really, do you understand what he's doing with time in the film? And once you understand that and see how the narratives intersect one another, do you still get joy out of watching the movie? And for me, in terms of, spoiling the ending, I very much do. I think this movie is one that I get. I still don't completely understand, and I've seen it a number of times, and yet I get the same amount of joy watching it every time I see it. I think Guy Pearce is exemplary in this role, and this was the first time I'd seen him. It was, I think, the first Christopher Nolan movie I'd seen.
It was not the first time you'd seen him.
It wasn't?
Shame on you. LA Confidential, hello.
Oh, you're absolutely right. No, you're right.
Oh my gosh.
You're right. Oh, for crying out loud, I'm going to regret that. Yes. No, it was the second time I'd seen him. Take two.
You hadn't seen Priscilla before?
Not probably before this movie.
Okay.
Maybe I saw it after. No, maybe I saw Priscilla in the theater. So that would have been before. I don't remember Guy Pearce as somebody that I was looking for.
Would you stop
messing with me right now? I watched the movie and I did not note it as a Guy Pearce vehicle until I saw this movie. I was like, oh, okay, Guy Pearce, here's somebody I should remember. All right. And so memory is a funny and difficult thing, isn't it? Ironic.
Yeah, very ironic.
So, I get a lot of joy out of watching this movie. How did it hit you this time around?
I'm always impressed when I watch this movie. I mean, it's not that complicated of a story. It really isn't. Like, when you lay it out as in linear fashion and you just look at it from beginning to end, the beginning starts in the black and white story and goes to the end of the actual film, and then we circle around and start moving backwards with all the color sequences as Leonard at this point is now dealing with the aftermath of everything that's happened with Jimmy, and then Dodd, and then eventually Teddy. And so we kind of follow through. But really what it is the twist that we get is the mental decisions that we have happening at the end as we see this kind of decision point with our main character, with Leonard, at the end of the film, that really kind of makes you rethink everything that's happened that you've seen chronologically after that point. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of shocking. And that's what I find so strong about the film. It's just such an interesting watch. And it's an easy watch, and it's so creative. And I love the moving back and forth in time and the way that Nolan plays that game with the story, because as I said, chronologically speaking, it's not that complicated of a story, but the way that he decided to tell it ends up framing it in such a unique way that you get this this much different look at a person and the way that they that memories can be, I suppose you could say, kind of used and abused to kind of go in different directions in your life. I guess that's one way we could kind of word it.
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think there is the way we see characters actively manipulating time by way of memory, right? They're actively manipulating the future by manipulating what, you know, what Lenny is able to remember and what he is able to document. And I think that's really nice to me. It has a lovely connection to just sort of how we document things through media, through, we remember history is written by the victors, right? And in this case, we're seeing that writ small, in terms of Lenny's experience of the world. And I think that's really cool. If it's not on a Polaroid, and depending what caption is on the Polaroid, that will determine if he continues in this infinite loop of vengeance, or if he's ever able to break free of it. I think that is a really cool conceit in this movie. I think it's really cool. And I think you are a bit dismissive of the complexities of watching the narratives interact the way they do. It is not that complex of a movie, but how many people watched this movie and sat down and really thought about time moving forward versus, you know, the segments of the story moving forward and moving backward? I think that is the unnatural piece when you see this movie for the first time. That's the part that challenges you as a film goer, and I think will largely determine if you like the movie, if you're willing to give it a second chance.
Yeah, some people really are frustrated by it. You know, yeah. I've talked to some people who just don't like the fact that it's moving forward and backward, and they get confused about, well, what happened first, and why, you know, why did they tell it this way? And I feel like the construction of the script is as important to the telling of the story as what's happening in the story. And the way that the characters move through it. I think that's critical. And because, yeah, I mean, you obviously, I mean, I know we talked about it last week and, you know, just saying it again here, there is a bonus feature on the DVD where you can actually watch the film chronologically. But there's a reason Christopher Nolan didn't make the film that way. You know, it's not, that's not what makes the compelling story. It's the construction that they went into to craft the story this way that makes
it. That gets to one of my big questions for you. Have you watched it chronologically? I assume you have.
I have, but not since I bought the DVD back in the early aughts. So it's been a very long time.
So this is my question. Is it, I mean, there is, as you say, there's a reason he made it the way he did, and that is a significant part of the story, is the fact that it's cut the way it is. Is there enough story to maintain your interest if you don't have that? Because one of the critiques I've read of the film is that the, you know, a particularly skeptical reviewer says that this is a gimmick. It's a gimmick to hide the fact that the story itself is weak. What is your take on that?
I think that the critic isn't far off. The story isn't that strong of a story. I mean, basically, we have a guy with very little memory who apparently, it seems to succeed in killing the person that had killed his wife. If that actually had happened, we're not sure. But anyway, he's now involved with these people and basically like killing people that they need offed, basically. I mean, he takes care, he kills Jimmy, he deals with Dodd, he ends up killing Teddy. And so there isn't much story. The critic is absolutely correct. But again, that's why the story is constructed the way it is, because the story, the film is not just about the story. It is about the character who is moving through this particular story and making some very critical decisions. And it becomes a film about the manipulation of memories and personal truths to basically make decisions that may, you know, make you happier with where you are, but aren't necessarily great. As we find out at the end of this particular film, we have Leonard who basically decides, you know what? I'm not that fan of this. I'm not a big fan of this Teddy guy anymore. I'm going to start leaving clues for myself so that maybe I end up killing him is kind of where we go, right? He manipulates himself. He puts the tattoo on his leg of Teddy's license plate number. He writes on the photo, you know, don't trust his lies. And all of these things lead to him at the end of the actual chronological story killing Teddy, thinking that Teddy was involved in possibly the murder of his wife.
Right.
And so that's a mental manipulation. And that's why we watch this story, not for the simple story that it is, but for this fascinating psychological study of a person making these decisions. And that's why the film is also constructed the way it is. So it's not a gimmick. I think that it becomes a very critical part to this psychological exploration.
Right. It's a game of Clue, right? It's Lenny in the warehouse with the gun, but I play Clue. I still enjoy it. It's a simple game. I still enjoy this movie. The movie is what we got on the screen. It is, I think, inseparable from the time, you know, quote, gimmick. It is inseparable from that mechanic. That is what makes it fun. That's what makes it interesting. And I think any more complicated a narrative underneath that gimmick would make it, nay, impossible and impenetrable. As it is, I think it's fun to unravel. And I think it works. It doesn't hurt that we have, I think, a great central cast in Guy Pearce, Carrie-Anne Moss, and Joe Pantoliano. They're terrific together as a complicated triangle.
They're all great. This is Carrie-Anne Moss and Joe Pantoliano coming onto this right after The Matrix. What a great kind of shift in a psychological kind of just another exploration of a really interesting world for the two mm-hmm. of them to hop into immediately. Because I think that they're both delivering just great performances here. I love the way both of them play their characters and working off of Guy Pearce as this person who has, you know, this anterior grade amnesia and is forgetting everything. I find it so interesting. And I think absolutely all three of them are incredibly compelling. I love the way they work together.
According to Nolan, Guy Pearce himself has an extremely high anxiety around his memory. He's constantly afraid that he's forgetting things and will always be checking with, you know, with the people around him. Did I remember this right? Did I get this right? Did I get this right? Which is ironic because he has a terrific memory, according to Nolan, that he said he actually became a touchstone for us to make sure that we were shooting the right thing in the right order and would catch them when, you know, things were out of place slightly as they were shooting, particularly in some of the more important narrative beats, that he would catch them. And it becomes incredibly useful. I think he nails this. He nails every single part of it. He nails the accent, totally believable the entire way. The physicality of the performance, I think, really fits. He's kind of sinewy, right? He just sort of fits that he's wearing a suit, but he kind of looks like he's in recovery somehow. I think it's great.
He does. Very much so. That's very true. I love that about him. And when we start getting the reveals of the tattoos and eventually, like, he takes off his shirt and is revealed that, yes, he's incredibly sinewy and almost skeletal, but also covered in just all these crazy tattoos. That is such an interesting moment in the film. And I think that it works really well. And I like the way it plays on just a kind of that body style. It just, mm-hmm. it feels very, I don't know, there's something about it. It just, I don't know, it just, it's catching and it's just, I don't know, there's, it's shocking the way that all of that comes across.
I want to talk about the unreliable narrators for Guy Pearce, for Leonard, because, you know, this movie is, it also, in addition to the mechanic of time, it kind of hinges on the fact that our narrator is unreliable. And that's not something, like, normally when you have an unreliable narrator, talking about, like, The Woman in the Window and what are some other recent unreliable narrator films that have come out, we've talked about. This one, or those movies, you sort of come to terms with the fact that your narrator is unreliable over time, over the course of the movie. That becomes a reveal of some sort. Oh my God, it's a twist. I can't trust what I've been seeing through the eyes of my protagonist. In this movie, we get that our narrator is unreliable from the jump, right? We know we can't necessarily trust what he sees or remembers from the outset of the film. Does that change the way you watch it?
There's a difference, I think, with an unreliable narrator like Leonard, because he has this memory loss and so just doesn't have any short-term memories. And so I think that that's interesting that he certainly is unreliable. We can't trust. I mean, he's relying on his own notes on these photos and everything. But I find that he plays as more trustworthy because you don't feel like he's up and up straight, like lying to you, or there's mm-hmm. things going on in his head. American Psycho is one we talked about recently. That's right, an interesting right. one where it seems like there's definitely, as we get to the end, there's some psychological thing going on in his head, you know, and so that's certainly one. Gone Girl is much more about manipulation. Here, it's like it's a medical thing that is leading to him kind of, you know, not remembering these things. And what I think is interesting is he's unreliable in a medical sense, but seems to be reliable, but it's not until, and this is why I think the film is strong, and this is why the twist at the end of the film works, because it's revealed that he really isn't, I mean, aside from being unreliable medically, he's also actually unreliable. And the way that he is actually manipulating evidence that he's planting, I mean, he's talking about, you know, facts versus memories and things like that, but we start realizing he's actually been manipulating facts, which we didn't realize. And mm-hmm. now we're going, oh, all the stuff that he thinks about Teddy isn't necessarily true. And Teddy has that moment where he says, you know, we got that guy a long time ago, but you weren't satisfied because you didn't remember it and you wanted to keep going. And so we just keep doing these other things. And that's a really interesting story. And then the whole idea of like, did that ever actually happen? Was there ever a wife for Sammy, or was Leonard the one who gave the injections to his wife and accidentally killed her? Like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on as we learn over the course of the film that makes Leonard more and more unreliable. And I like the way they play the idea of the unreliable narrator and twist it from semi-trustworthy because it's just medical to a point where we're just like, we can't trust anything from this guy.
Well, the first time I sat down and watched this with my wife, it was, you know, she asked the question as he's writing on the Polaroid, so why is he doing that? And we talked through, well, he's doing that so he'll remember it tomorrow when he can't make these new memories. And her comment, which I think is quite astute, was, what's he going to get out of that? That's the worst clue ever. Why is he writing in code? Yeah. Of course, that's Chekhov's Polaroid, right? Of course, that's going to fail at some point. We just need to know when it's going to fail. So I think that is another, like, it could be a critique of the substance of our protagonist's unreliability, which is he's writing terrible notes. If you really had this issue, you might have a little bit, maybe more complete sentences, more than just license tags, license plate numbers. Like, probably the tattoos aren't the best way to cement, you know, your future.
He needs to be John Doe from Seven, writing copious journals that fill rooms that he can constantly be referencing.
That's the character mashup we've needed all along, Lenny and John Doe. But I do think this is important. You mentioned again the idea that did it all really happen, or was it really just Leonard and his wife, and that there was no Sammy Jenkins. What do you think?
I don't know. And I don't know. I feel like this is something that Nolan likes to do with his stories, is not necessarily make it where there's an obvious answer. I mean, same thing at the end of Inception. Does the top fall or not? Does it matter? And I think to a certain extent, we get that here. You know, was Leonard ever, attacked at his house, and was his wife killed? Or did that happen? She survived. She has, you know, dealt with insulin injections. I mean, I guess that was kind of what they were saying. It was like, maybe she survived and then he was giving her, but he'd always been giving her injections, right?
That's kind of my understanding, that that was the problem.
Yeah. And then the question is, you know, did he actually give her too many injections? And basically, Sammy Jenkins's wife was essentially his wife and was tired of this life and was trying to get him to break and asked him to keep injecting her until she went into a coma and died. That's pretty shocking.
That's shocking, but I didn't think it was like she was exhausted. I think she was just really trying to test whether or not this was legit.
Well, yeah. I mean, when he's talking about it on the phone, he's saying, you know, he says something to that extent. Like, I don't know if she just was tired of you know, continuing to try or something like that. So I don't know. I like the idea that it could be that way. You know, he could have killed his wife through too many insulin injections. It could be that she was attacked and died. I don't know if it matters. And what I think is interesting is that no matter what, it's going to all be kind of built into this kind of faulty memory bank now. And, you know, I don't know if we'll ever really know.
That's the part, I guess, I can't connect now that we're talking about it, is in order for him to end up in this loop, right, where he's going after the vengeance, at some point, his wife had to have been attacked somehow, right? Doesn't he need that inciting incident in order to get there? And if he killed his wife with injections...
Well, that's what I was thinking that they were saying, is that there always was an attack. That's where his memory loss started. Mm-hmm. But
my after recollection that, she survived.
Like, either she survived or she died. And in his memory, she died. But then we have that moment where she's under the shower curtain and she's blinking because she's actually alive. And then post-attack, and he's now got the anterior grade memory loss.
He is Sammy Jenkins.
He is Sammy Jenkins, right?
Yep. Yep. Okay.
And the real Sammy Jenkins was just a guy who he was helping, but didn't have a wife or something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely it. He was just a con. I think that's exactly it. And that's how I remember. And so I feel a little bit more sure that there was no Sammy Jenkins and his wife, that in fact, it was actually Georgia Fox the whole time. And that she was the one who was questioning, is this real? And I'm going to test it by seeing if he'll do the thing that is most sacred to him, their relationship, if he will violate that intentionally, or if it's, you know, if he'll go so far as to potentially kill her, then that will be a test. And also, she just can't like live with that uncertainty anymore. It's like not worth living.
Right. It's that constant frustration with this idea that her husband might just be faking it and kind of using this to whatever avail, you know, for whatever reason. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Grim. But that's why it's such an interesting story, because you have that as this potential place where Leonard is coming from, and which is dark and it's horrifying. But yeah, it's a person with this memory loss, this short-term memory loss. And when potentially, if he's working with Teddy, who I don't know, my assumption is that he actually was a cop, but when he's working with him and they kill a person, and then Leonard wakes up, you know, minutes or moments later, and is just like ready to go kill somebody because he doesn't remember it. And that's just, it's an interesting way to kind of keep playing that, because even with that photo, I mean, he hadn't written any notes on it, and perhaps that's to his detriment, but the photo of him, you know, it's kind of a bloody picture, and he looks all happy, and he's like, you know, got the spot on his chest where he's going to get the tattoo, never did. And now he's just like, still feels like he has to go out and find the person who killed his wife. And that's when it seems like Teddy starts using him to kind of take out some other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is such a diabolical mechanic.
It is very much so. And that's, I mean, that was my sense of the way that the rest of the story plays out, is it seemed like he had something with Jimmy because I was like, well, maybe he was just trying to get the, I don't know, 200,000 or whatever that Jimmy had brought. Because that seems like why he's always in the car. He's trying to can get that money out of it. And then that gets him involved with Natalie, who then figures out about... Oh, they all seem to know him, though. I mean, everybody knows, oh, he's the memory loss guy. Like, they know who he is. So he's already in that world. And then, so Teddy uses him to take out Jimmy. Natalie's upset about that. Uses him to deal with Dodd. And then he kind of sets this whole thing up where he can take out Teddy also. So
it's one of those that's so tricky, because I think you don't know what you need to pay attention to. You know, I think back specifically to the hotel clerk the manager up front. Like, knowing when it's important to pay attention to why he is taking Lenny to different rooms, to the wrong room, I think is a funny play. And I don't think that is one of those clues that necessarily matters to the overall arc of the story. We know he's involved somehow as a like a front for the drug dealing, but doesn't necessarily matter to the overall looping that's going on and how Lenny's being used.
It's just another example of somebody manipulating him to get something out of him, which I think is great. I love Mark Boone Jr. anyway, so it's so fun seeing him in this little role. And when he's kind of like has that little chuckle, oh yeah, I figured, you know, business is slow. What can I say?
Yeah. Talk about a face. Like, Mark Boone Jr. is, I mean, he's in everything. He's always the smarmy detective or the smarmy hotel operator he's smarmy pretty much everywhere.
Yes. That kind of fits his style. He's just got a great look, especially when he's bearded. It just very much works. So, yeah.
I think the real joy is Stephen Tobolowsky.
He's always a joy. I just love Tobolowsky. And this, I feel like he may get more screen time in this than so many other things, because he's always used as a really memorable bit player with just like a scene or two, you know, like Groundhog Day or Basic Instinct or things like that. This is an opportunity for him to have a larger supporting role. And it's an interesting one, and I really like it. And especially that scene, and I think Harriet Sansom Harris deserves as much recognition as Tobolowsky does in the scene where he's giving her all the injections. Like, the way that she keeps asking him just breaks my heart when you see her going through that.
Like, there is a character drama built in here that I would watch at feature length. Do you know what I mean? Like, that backstory is really interesting, and I would love to see those two people, Harris and Tobolowsky, in those roles. Like, that's a movie that should have been made.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah.
We did mention Georgia Fox, and I just have to say, 21 years this year, she is the same. She's got the same character, Sarah Seidel, in CSI. 15 years, season after season, on the air.
That's where I've seen her from. She's one of those faces. Yeah. I'm like, I know I've seen you somewhere. There was a brief period, you know, I'm not a big TV watcher, but there was this window of time where my wife and I were watching CSI quite a bit. And I don't know, a season or two is probably what I made it through. And yes, absolutely, 100%. Now I can totally place her.
It won't surprise you to know that I watched the whole thing. I was a big fan. I was not as rigorous a viewer of ER, but she did 3-4 years on ER before this. And then came Memento, and then came her entree to CSI, which... She's great. She was great in CSI.
CSI started after this? I always thought it started in the 90s. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because it's been around so long. 2015.
Yeah. Wow. That was the original scene. And then they did a couple of movies. I think one was released, I think, as a two-parter. Then there was a TV movie, CSI Mortality, in 2015. And that sort of ended things. But she is back in CSI Vegas, the limited series that has been announced for this year, later this year. I think they're doing 8 or 10 episodes, which should be a lot of fun. I, for one, am looking forward to it.
Wow, interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. Well, she's great. It's not a big role, but she makes a lot of her small parts, that little scenes that she has. I like seeing her in here.
Right.
Now, here's a question for you. Could you imagine watching this with Brad Pitt playing Leonard? Because that was the initial casting.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I have Seven in my memory. Like, that's kind of that's the sort of Brad Pitt look and character that I kind of imagine in this role. So it's pretty easy for me to, it's a fungible resource. You know, I can imagine that.
He could very easily pull off this sort of role. He dropped out because of scheduling conflicts, I guess. And then they were considering Aaron Eckhart and Thomas Jane, but Nolan really liked Guy Pearce, and also because Pearce had a lack of celebrity. And after Pitt was gone from the project, they decided to drop the A-list stars and make the film for less money by using somebody who is quality, but also more affordable. And Pierce was very enthusiastic. for it. And so I think that, I think that makes sense that he did that instead.
Well, because just I'm checking my timelines here, right? Because he had already, he was just coming off of Fight Club when this was
made. No. Fight Club was 5 years before. He would have been doing Snatch. Oh, no. Fight Club was right before. He would have
Fight
been doing
Club
Snatch.
Fight Club was 99. Right. Snatch was 2000. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking of Seven. Yeah. Reason. But yeah, he Snatch, he would have been, let's see, because they filmed this.
Because he already had, his 90s were stellar with Interview with the Vampire and Legends of the Fall and Seven and 12 Monkeys. That was it.
Yeah. Let's not forget The Devil's Own, Pete.
Well, I was going to say Sleepers, but I know you did forget Sleepers.
Yeah.
That was terrible.
Yeah. There were a number of films that he was in the late 90s that weren't quite so big, 7 Years in Tibet, Meet Joe Black. But Fight Club, certainly, then Snatch.
Sleepers has a 7.6 on the IMDb scale. How is that even possible?
Sleepers isn't bad. It's not bad.
It was? I hated the book. I hated the book so much that it makes me... I'm rating the book when I write. I could, Oh, well, what are you going to do?
Go scream at a bookstore.
You don't have to be snotty. You don't have to. You don't have to take your rage out on me. You're projecting right now. It's a projection.
Is that what I'm doing?
That's what you're doing. Okay. Brad Pitt, Carrie Ann Moss. You want to talk a little bit more about her?
I just thought that I think Mary McCormick was trying to get the part, but because of her role as Trinity, I think, the producers were really impressed with her and brought a lot to the part. So I'm thrilled that they came on, that she was interested too. Same thing with Panigliano. Dennis Leary was mentioned but not available. It's just what a weird cast that would have been. Brad Pitt, Mary McCormick, and Dennis Leary. It's such a strange new version of this.
But you know what? Now after something it's just so great to see her continued body of work. Mary McCormick, I think she's fantastic. But I could see all of those people in this movie. I absolutely could. It's sort of an accident. There are a lot of great names that have been tossed around for this one. I think they landed on a great trio, but I could totally see anyone else that is on that list in here.
Yeah, I definitely could.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a strong cast, and I think that especially on a limited budget that they were working with here, I think on a limited schedule. I mean, they shot it in just 25 days. It was very quick, and they, obviously Nolan was, proving that he knew how to kind of get in and out when he was doing a project like this, and I think it worked exceptionally well, and with a great team. I mean, great actors and great crew. And I think this
Wally Pfister.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this where he kicks things off with Pfister?
I believe so, because this was before this was The Following, right? And he shot that himself, Nolan.
And I think he's worked with Pfister, not on everything else, but because Pfister stopped after Dark Knight Rises, and that's when he switched over to
Hoyta van Hoytema.
Yeah. But I love what Pfister was doing.
What is going on with Wally Pfister? Why hasn't he done anything of substance since Dark Knight Rises?
Well, I don't know. I know he directed some TV stuff. And, he did Transcendence, which everyone tries to forget happened. I don't know if he largely stepped out of... I mean, maybe he's moved more into just doing commercials and things like that now, I don't know.
Yeah, it's too bad, because I really enjoy his work, and he's blessedly, he's an easy cinematographer to catch up on, because his big films are the big films.
Yeah, it's frustrating. He certainly had a great career filming stuff, and I don't know why he shifted into whatever it is he's doing now.
Yeah. Well, miss him in the biz. Dodie Dorn served as editor on this one, and I just want to say, this is an editing job right here. This is an editing. It's it's a fun editing job. I think it's cool that Doty and Wally went on to do another great looking film, Insomnia, together in 2002, which I think we have a high opinion of.
You know what's interesting about Insomnia, about the disc of Insomnia, is that I feel like Nolan was at this point when he was releasing these movies where he was trying to find ways to entice people to think about them in different ways, like the fact that you could watch Memento chronologically on the DVD.
Oh, God, what did they do on the disc?
In Insomnia, they released it where you could actually watch...
It's a Pacino-only cut. It cuts out everything but Pacino.
You could actually watch it in shooting order. And so you watch the entire film. It doesn't make any sense because you're watching the film in out of order. But what I read somebody say is it was actually really interesting to watch, and you can actually see Al Pacino figuring out the character. Like as it starts, you know, he doesn't seem as connected, but by the time you get to the end, he feels like he's more the character.
That's
funny. Well, that's kind of an interesting way to kind of go about it. I don't know why anyone would want to actively watch the movie that way.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Oh, clearly, sociopaths. It's the Robin Williams collector that wants to watch that.
Right.
Okay. All right. You want to talk about music?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the music, I think, works in context of the film. It's not a score that I go back to listen to.
We should say it's David Julian.
David Julian, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
who also did the aforementioned Insomnia, and you can actually watch one cut on the DVD of Insomnia. It's score only. It's just a black. It's just score. Anyway, go ahead.
But it's I think that he's a fine composer. He started with Nolan with Following, and ended with Insomnia. So it was a short-lived time together, but, you know, he ended up moving on to doing other things like, you know, Cabin in the Woods and
which was great.
The Descent.
That was fun.
And he did The Prestige. I forgot about that
one. Yeah, he did The Prestige.
So, but I think then that's after which Nolan switches to Hans Zimmer and kind of that whole world. But, I think the music is fine here. It works in context of the film.
It's like when your best friend in the eighth grade goes to high school and starts hanging out with a different group of people. And you're like, wait a minute, what are we doing here? We were best friends 3 months ago, and now we're back. And your ears pierced? That's what happened. Christopher Nolan got his ear pierced and dyed his hair and left people like David Julian and Doty and Wally to hang out with each other.
Yeah.
Rough. Takes me back. Okay. I've come off the rails. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. How did it do at awards season?
It did really well for itself. It was a surprise kind of hit, and it ended up getting a lot of notice. It had 57 wins with 59 other nominations. At the Oscars, there was a little bit of controversy about it as far as the writing award, because they were really, this is Nolan and his brother, Jonathan Nolan, because the way that the film is set up, it says, you know, written by Christopher Nolan, based on the story Memento Mori by Jonathan Nolan. And so initially it was only eligible for the adapted screenplay, but then they, you know, had this thing. And it, my recollection is that they kind of, you know, pushed back on the Academy for this because they wanted the original screenplay nomination instead, saying that, you know, the book was, or the short story was actually based on this that they had come up with, and that Memento Mori, they came up with the story together. So just the actual story, Christopher wrote the movie and then Jonathan wrote the short story, is kind of the way they pitched it.
And that's their fault. That's it is. Their fault. Yeah. They pitched it wrong. As Nolan tells it, Jonathan told him the story in a road trip from Chicago to Los Angeles. He said, here's a story I'm working on. And they started workshopping it into a movie. The story was published after.
And so my hunch was that he was putting his brother's name in the credits that way so that it would increase more visibility for him. Like, yeah. I'm not exactly sure,
but the problem is for your brother.
It was. The problem was it put them into, I mean, no matter what, they had tough categories, but I thought they had a better chance if they, or they thought they, I think, had a better chance at being original. However, they lost to Gosford Park. A Beautiful Mind ended up winning adapted screenplay. I don't know, you know, would it have beaten A Beautiful Mind? I'd like to think so. I don't think that's my favorite of stories. But Gosford Park, I mean, Julian Fellowes, it's a pretty strong script. I do like that. I think I would put, it was also Memento, Monsters Ball, The Royal Tenenbaums, and Amelie. So it was a strong year of original screenplays. So I don't know. I'm a little torn as to how that went down, but that's how it did go down. And then Dodie Dorn was nominated for Best Editing, but lost to Black Hawk Down. At the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror, it won the Saturn Award for Best Action Adventure Thriller. And Best Actor Guy Pearce was nominated but lost to Tom Cruise in Vanilla Sky. At the Film Independent Spirit Awards, it won Best Feature, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Supporting Female for Carrie Ann Moss, but lost Best Cinematography to Peter Deming for Mulholland Drive. And at the Golden Schmoes, it won for the Most Underrated Movie of the Year, the trippiest movie of the year. Guy Pearce won Best Actor. Also breakthrough performance. It won Best Line in the, okay, so what am I doing? Oh, I'm chasing this guy. No, he's chasing me. Won for that, which is great. And it also won Best Script. It lost Favorite Movie to Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. It also, Joe Pantoliano lost Best Supporting Actor to Ian McKellen, also for Lord of the Rings. Carrie Ann Moss lost the Best Supporting Actress to Jennifer Connelly in Beautiful Mind. Favorite Movie Poster lost to Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. And the coolest character for Leonard Shelby, lost to Jay and Silent Bob for Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch.
That's a tough one.
Okay. Well, I have all kinds of issues with that, but we'll go ahead and move on. How to do at the box office.
For Nolan's breakout hit, he had a strong $9 million to work with. That is $13 million in today's dollars. The movie premiered at the Venice International Film Festival September 2000, then had its domestic release March 16, 2001, opening in a limited release opposite Exit Wounds, Enemy at the Gates, American Desi, and The Dish. It definitely was a word-of-mouth film, slowly gaining popularity over the weeks until it finally cracked the top 10 in its ninth week of release. It stayed there for three more weeks and stayed in theaters for a total of 41 weeks. A really strong release. This film went on to earn $25.5 million domestically and $14.5 million internationally for a total gross of $58 million in today's dollars. Strong movie for Nolan, landing him with an adjusted profit per finished minute of almost $400,000.
Well, that's something.
Yeah, not too bad.
He did okay. It's a nice kickoff to the career. I really enjoy this movie. I enjoy my time with this movie, and I'm glad to get it on the list. I feel like Nolan's films, whatever you think of them, I think they're fun to talk about. This has been a good series. Closing thoughts?
It's just a fantastic film. I hadn't revisited it in ages. Really glad to look at it again. And now I feel like it's a little violent, but at the same time, I'm like, I, feel like I could almost introduce my daughter to this now. Like, it's it's such a strong film with such a creative story.
Oh, totally. Let's take the mat and see what's happening.
Let's do it.
All right. Head over to flickchart.com/the next reel. You'll see all the films we've talked about on this very show. If you swipe over in your show notes and tap the word flickchart, it should take you to this film in the flickchart database where you can add it to your list and see how it stacks up against ours.
First up, Memento or Wall Street?
Memento.
Memento. Memento or Fargo?
I'm going to give it to Memento.
The problem here, clearly, is that Fargo is too low on our list. I got to go.
Yeah, and what are we going to do about that? Nothing right now. That's not our job right now.
It's not our job right now. I have to say Fargo, though.
All right.
It's a tough one because I don't want Memento to drop, but I would say Fargo.
All right. Let's do it.
Here we go. One, two, three.
Scissors. Oh, for crying out loud. You should feel so guilty about this.
I do. Memento or Friday?
Memento.
Absolutely Memento. Memento or The Verdict?
Memento.
Say Memento. Memento or Ronin? That's this Ronin. Should be a tough one for you.
It is. It's not, actually. It's Ronin for me.
Of course. It's Memento for me here.
Okay.
All right, here we go. One.
One.
Two. Three.
Three.
Paper. Scissors.
Paper.
Memento takes it. Memento, I just want to point out, had it beaten Fargo, it would already have beaten Ronin. So there you go.
Yeah, but it didn't. It didn't. So what are you going to do? Click chart. Don't play me. Don't play me, Andy.
Well, this is another tough one for you. Memento or Hudson Hawk?
This is harder than the Ronin one because I know what it represents.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely Memento for me.
Yeah, I know. Okay, it's Memento.
Oh, wow. Okay. Memento or Europa Europa?
Memento.
Memento. Memento or Rocky Balboa?
Memento.
Memento. Memento or Platoon?
I feel like you're quizzing me right now. I feel like that's where we are. It's Memento.
Memento. That lands Memento in spot 130 on our chart. One spot below Fargo. It is 130 out of 515 films. That puts it, sadly, at a 75%.
Wow. That's crazy.
That means Fargo is at a 75%, which is just
that's
also
insanity.
Wrong.
I feel like we should do a bonus re-ranking starting now and just get Fargo out of the way.
Absolutely.
It's higher on my list, and it ran into some tough competition. How'd it do on yours?
Yeah, very well. It's in spot 158 on my chart out of 4651. That's a 97%.
Wow, that's fantastic. No, it actually ran into some things that were hard to justify for me. It ended up at 218 out of 1510, which is an 86%. If I go by the algorithm at letterboxd.com/the next reel, this should be a 4.5-star film. And it has been for years a 4.5-star film on my list. And definitely has a heart. The question is, does it stay at 4.5 stars? That's the big question.
I don't know how that's a question. It's been a 5-star film for me ever since I saw it.
Yeah, I knew that it would be. I knew that it would be. And I'm trying to remember, what was the quibble? What was the quibble that I have with this film? Because we just talked about it for an hour, and I can't find it. Based on the conversation,
I wouldn't think that any stars had fallen for you.
Yeah, it actually kind of surprised me this morning when I saw it again at 4.5 stars. I think it's probably a 5-star film. I'm going to go ahead and move that up. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's 5-star and a heart.
There you go.
All right. It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
the originals page at thenextreel.com/originals, links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. This was good. This was like an intervention, I think, more than a podcast.
Apparently so. Apparently so. Well, it was a good one. It was a great way to kick off our spoilery twist ending film series. Albeit a brief one, but it was a good one to kick things off.
Oh, I love it. I'm having a great time just thinking about movies that I would like to talk about in further iterations of this series. What, anything you would like me to think about as I go into watching your pick again this week?
If I had watched it more recently, yes. But I haven't seen it in ages. And I just remember really enjoying it. But now that I know everything, I am really curious, like you, like how well is this thing going to hold up? So we are, of course, talking about James Mangold's 2003 film, Identity.
There was a storm.
It was an accident. We had an accident.
And we got stuck and we couldn't get out. We couldn't get out because of the storm.
It's flooded. It's a dead end.
You the manager? Officer Rose. Transporting a prisoner here. But the roads are all flooded and I could use a room.
I don't think we can get out tonight.
I'm not staying here. Are you out of your mind?
There is no place else to go.
What happened to the motel? People started dying.
What's going on?
Go in your room and lock your door.
And then their bodies, they disappeared.
Nobody in there.
That's not possible. I saw what happened. We all saw what happened.
This doesn't make any sense.
Maybe there's some connection between all of us.
Like what?
My birthday next week.
Me too.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. A way to wrap up our little pair of twisty films. Thank you all to all of our members for your support. Andy, I don't know if you know this, we have another bonus episode coming up.
Woohoo!
We are talking about Naked Lunch, adding another member bonus to our David Cronenberg series. I can't wait to watch this film again, especially after the fun we had with our David Cronenberg series this last, was it a year ago? Has it been a year since we did David Cronenberg? Wow.
Wow, boy, has it?
Time it probably flies.
Yeah.
We have done a lot of member bonus episodes. We've done Gone Girl and the Russia House and Equilibrium and Ivanhoe and Tenet and Hot Rock and Thelma and Louise and Dolomite Is My Name and The Big Heat. So many member bonus episodes. If you want to hear them, just make sure you join up at the two reeler level and support this show and all of the shows that are under the family of The Next Reel.
And if you sign up at the one reeler level, you can still vote in our Saturday matinee polls. Every week, we choose a list topic that we have on the Saturday matinee. that is based on the movie that we're talking about right now. So that's a fun way to get your vote in for that. And that's just $1 a month.
Much fun. And just another community service reminder. For those who've been subscribed to the show for a long time, we do release a lot of content in the Next Reel Master feed. Don't forget, we have separated all of the show feeds out into individual show feeds. So if you just want to subscribe to the Next Reel, you can do that. Or the Film Board, you can do that too. Just want to hear the Saturday Matinee? You can subscribe just to that too. Just search up the Next Reel anywhere you get your podcasts, and you should see all of the shows, and you can pick and choose. It's a bouquet of Next Reel shows.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins. Letterboxd giveth, Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
Okay, so there are people who don't like this movie. Did you know that?
I did.
There's a lot of foul language at the bottom of the barrel. So much. They just have a lot of rage.
It's like they know they're at the bottom of the barrel.
They do. They're trying to be heard. I'm going to write a bottom of the barrel review. I have one that's a little bit longer. Do you mind if I go first and yours can be the punchline?
Let's do it.
Okay. This is from Teto Rapper. It's a 1-star. Going to cut to the chase with this one. I thought it was atrocious. Whilst being overcomplicated was absolutely something I expected coming into this film, what seriously let me down was this early Nolan hit is the characterization. I didn't give two hoots about Guy Pearce's Leonard. In fact, I would go as far as to say I found his performance downright irritating. While yes, I understand there is certainly complexity to a character that has a shoddy short-term memory, but I want you to imagine if Memento was a nice toast and that the whole memories concept was butter. Throughout the film, Nolan spread this butter so hard on the poor toast that, in my opinion, it created a bunch of holes in the bread and ultimately damaged my overall enjoyment of the film. Granted, no film is for everyone, and maybe I'm just a dummy, but I would choose Inception's carefully crafted narrative or even Tenet's slightly overblown spectacle over this pretentious slob of cinematic vomit any day of the week. That is the best way of explaining why I felt the main premise of this film just came across as novel, amateurish, and flat-out uninteresting. Toward the end, it even started to become unbearable.
Wow.
Wow. The toast metaphor. Toast with the holes, the heart spreading. We're going to have to bring that back. I'm going to have to use that again.
Yeah. Breaking the bread.
Breaking the bread. Yeah. Overspreading. You're overspreading.
Overspreading, apparently.
What do you got?
I've got a 0.5-star by Matt McDonald, who had this to say. Thought this was about a bento box full of memes. Very different film in reality.
Okay, I'm going to try and work bento box into my conversation today, too. All right, I'll do it.
Meme bento.
It's meme bento. Well, that's a bento meme. Okay, I get it. It kind of rolls off the tongue. Yeah, we'll see.
And if that's not good enough for you, here's what Guy Pearce had to say about the Letterboxd review celebrating the film's 20th anniversary.
The best review of Memento on Letterboxd basically said, this is what Finding Dory should have been.
Thanks, Letterboxd. Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
If you'd like to learn more about membership, head on over to thenextreel.com/membership where you can see how you can join and support the show.
Thanks, everybody. I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms, but in August 2022... we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15 plus years, Transistor has been hands down the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.